Hi, welcome. This is How to Die. I'm Sean O'Connor, your mortal host. In this episode, I'm inviting you to explore some of the links between death and birth. Moments perhaps on opposite shores of life, or events bookending a journey, or even superimposed in a cycle, the one needing the other. Look at any gravestone in the cemetery and there they are. They belong together. Life demands it. Life, beautifully described as a brief pause between two mysteries by Leonardo da Vinci, implying a relationship between birth and death, some kind of similarity. So how do these twinned mysteries fit into each other? What's the tension between them? To help explore this, I'm proud to have as my guest Siska van Straten, a mother, a teacher, a friend, a whole bunch of other things, and a midwife. And to listen to her experience of bringing life into the world and the related act of witnessing life depart. The word midwife comes from Middle English midwif, which literally means with woman. Mid meaning with, and wif in the archaic sense, not the aromatic one, meaning woman, usually woman with woman, though the term has escaped its gendered confines and some now even call themselves death midwives. So the word midwife seems to have stretched across life itself, describing a supportive role in the transition from one realm to another, a guide, perhaps even birthing death back into the cycle of life or life in death. A bit of trivia, free of charge, you do get a midwife toad. The male carries fertilized eggs on his back, legs around Northern Europe, Latin name Elites obstetricans from the word obstetrics, which we all know comes from a character in Asterix and Obelix Give Birth. It's quite a hard volume to get hold of. More trivia, obstetrics from the Latin verb obstare, to stand in front of, and the suffix trix as in dominatrix, the feminine. So an obstetrician is someone who stands in front of the woman. In a literal sense, though, in many places in the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Asia, the very act of giving birth is still closely associated with death. Maternal mortality is defined by the World Health Organization as the death of a woman while pregnant or within 42 days of termination of pregnancy of childbirth-related causes. In South Africa, the maternal mortality ratio, or MMR, in 2020 was 88 deaths per 100,000 births, which is pretty high considering the rate is 2 per 100,000 in Italy, which is the lowest MMR in the world. So despite the global MMR almost halving in the last 30 years or so, as recently as 2017, 808 women were dying from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes every day. That's roughly one person every 2 minutes, according to the UN Population Fund. 295,000 deaths in that year alone. Most are preventable. Moving on, in South Africa, the traditional birth attendant is often referred to as an ababelethisi, a centuries-old, highly respected role. Most ababelethisi practice in rural areas and townships, usually older women, well esteemed for their expertise. One requirement for becoming one includes having 2 children of your own, as well as plenty of training. We're talking 15 to 20 years, and the service is free. However, donations in the form of gifts are usually given, just like this podcast. In Europe, historically, it was taboo for men to practice midwifery, and in the 15th century, when a midwife, especially in the countryside, was associated with a string of unsuccessful births, the accusations of witchcraft began. Quite a few historians, in fact, draw a link between attempts to regulate midwifery and the emergence of witch trials. Later on in the 18th century, men began to assert their modern scientific techniques as better for mothers and infants than the folk medicine practiced by midwives. Even if where men were involved, maternal mortality rates tended to be higher still. Male-dominated medical associations pushed for a legal monopoly on obstetrical care. Midwifery even became outlawed or heavily regulated throughout places like the US. I suspect that the perception of pregnancy and childbirth as potentially pathological and dangerous continues to insinuate itself into popular medically influenced socio-cultural narratives, just like death has been medicalized too. How do we do birth and death more naturally? Perhaps things are changing. And with that, welcome to the show. How's it, Siska?
Hello, Sean.
Siska van Straten, does that mean Siska of the streets?
Mm-hmm.
Really, do you get around quite a bit?
I do.
Are you kind of on call as a midwife at any given moment?
I used to be. For many years, I'm no longer.
All right.
I have a birth coming up, but it's someone very dear and close to me.
Right.
And so I teach currently, but very much still in my memory and soul, the driving around and being on the road.
Sure. Okay. I wasn't aware that you weren't practicing, but you are practicing in a sense. I mean, in a vicarious sense, you're present at all the births that your students are with.
Mm.
Your journey to this point in your life as a teaching midwife, can I call you a midwife?
Or yes, you can definitely.
Is that how you refer to yourself?
Yes, definitely. I'm a midwife.
Okay.
I'm teaching at UCT Med School now.
Oh, right.
So I teach medical students obstetric skills and how to deal with obstetric emergencies. So I try and plant midwifery seeds.
Okay.
The seeds that I'm talking about is just planting seeds of midwifery wisdom.
Okay.
Midwifery sensitivity, midwifery ethics.
Right.
Instead of just medicalizing the patient, looking at the patient as a woman with rights and autonomy.
That's interesting because there's quite a lot of talk about how death has become medicalized. And it's interesting to hear you describe birth as something that's also become medicalized.
Oh, very much so.
Yeah. So we're here to discuss some of the links and similarities between these two moments of birth and death. And just in my reading, becoming aware of the fact that birth has often been associated with death through history, it seems like quite a perilous moment, the moment of birth.
Mm-hmm.
So, can you talk about some of the seeds that you're planting in the sense of how you'd like them to grow?
Look, it's very hard because I have to follow the curriculum. I have to teach them the skills.
Okay.
And it's quite repetitive. So it's very different to what I used to do. My life used to be completely unpredictable. I used to be on call all the time. Now I have scheduled work. I go and I teach the same thing over and over and over, week after week, to a group of students, new students.
Okay.
So, again, I have to do it organically and authentically. So when I see gaps where a student is responsive, I veer off the topic.
Okay.
And I talk to them about what it really means for a woman to go through labor and that whole process and what it means to the baby. And so I don't have the platform to, if I could have taught midwives, that would have been
right.
Just fantastic.
Yeah.
But I really am just planting seeds where I see there's a bit of fertile soil.
So, I mean, you must be registered as a midwife in this country in order to practice.
Yes.
So is midwifery taught as a specific thing or how does one become a midwife?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We have a 4-year nursing training program where the nurses do general nursing, psychiatric nursing, community nursing, and midwifery.
Okay.
In the past, it used to be very different. You would do your general training, which I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was a 2-year training, and then you could specialize in those different aspects and do an extra year of it. So by the time I started training in 94, it had amalgamated into this four-year program.
Right.
Which was very problematic because it's way too short.
Okay.
The training is inferior. The experience is too short. So by the end of the time that someone is qualified as a registered nurse and midwife, she seriously lacked experience and knowledge.
Okay.
There's a little bit of book knowledge. So that's where my journey took me. I realized that immediately after qualifying, I got a job and realized that I knew nothing.
Okay. So that was after a four-year...
After a four-year training. So I resigned from that first job that I got immediately, and I returned back to the state hospital where I did my training and then worked there.
Right.
And gained more experience. And then I met all these angels that came out of the woodwork, older women, midwives. Yeah. They taught me. And that's where my learning really started, learning from other midwives.
So in a sense, you're carrying on that tradition quite actively.
Well, not as good as I wished to, I would have loved to.
Don't be so modest. No, really.
Well, yeah, I see little fertile spots of soil with those students. And, you know, it's students of all genders. It's not just women. There's sometimes very surprising students who I can see they actually get it. Mm-hmm. But very few people get it.
What does getting it mean?
Getting it means there's a knowing. There's a knowing that there is something bigger than just the practical medical stuff that we need to do going on here.
Right.
Something beyond our control, really. Okay. The process, so to speak.
So people call birth a miracle sometimes. That's a word that's often allied with the idea of birth. And I just want to explore this idea of what people get when they get it. Is it getting that it's quite a sacred thing or a journey that plumbs depth that we might not really comprehend? Mm. You can't put them in a textbook. It sounds intensely human. I'm just trying to explore the contours of what getting it means. And, you know, I think it's fine to describe it as a sacred moment or a spiritual moment, because that 9-month gestation journey, and I think it teaches people things.
Oh, no, absolutely. I'm not a language person. I'm not a word person.
Okay.
So if someone were to say to me that it's sacred or it's holy, that's when I get it, because that's the word they are using
to describe it. Okay.
My patients over the years of, you know, doing independent midwifery or private midwifery with patients ranged from very religious Christian patients, very religious Jewish patients, and very religious Muslim patients.
Okay.
And then the very strong alternative, what we used to very flippantly call the lentil heads.
Right.
And the minute there's a strong faith, whether it's a religious or a spiritual or, for lack of a better word, any drive, that's when people excel. They do it with grace. And it doesn't matter if it is, it's the in-between sort of nowhere people who don't really believe in anything, who struggle.
Okay.
Because there isn't that connection to a trust, something bigger.
Right.
And whatever that bigger may be, whether it's a spiritual or religious.
Okay.
Does that answer you in a way?
Absolutely. You did refer to the idea of something bigger much earlier when we were talking. So that makes sense to me.
Yeah, an unknown.
When I mentioned earlier that death has always been associated with birth through the centuries, is that something that you sensed when you were in a room with someone who was about to give birth? Did you feel a sense of this could go in any direction? It's a tricky moment, it feels like to me.
Our medical knowledge has enabled us to differentiate between people who are at risk and at medium risk, high risk, low risk. So whether a patient is deemed low risk and therefore falling into the category of being cared for by a midwife legitimately or with confidence, that fear of things going wrong is very small.
Yeah.
Because you would screen your people, but it never goes away. So whenever you are with a woman in labor, there's always that little twist in your tummy, you know, that little voice telling you, watch out for this, watch out for that. And that could be seen as anxiety and paranoia, but it, you know, it helps to create a vigilance. And yes, women do die. Low-risk women also die. But, you know, in the setting that we have in Cape Town, where we did home births and births in low-risk units, we always had arranged backup and a set of tools, you know, a little toolbox. One of the biggest causes would be bleeding, postpartum hemorrhage. So right. We would have the means to stop a bleed. But what I just want to say, Sean, is that there's a bit of a confusing thing for me here between who are we comparing the dying process and the birthing process? Which two are we comparing? Are we comparing the journey of the baby being born and brought into the life, into our life, and then a person at the end of their life dying? Or are we looking at the mother's process of giving birth? Or is it a dyad?
Yeah, I would say that it's a whole constellation of birth and death, and everyone is involved in that. So it's the whole gang.
Yeah, it's not really a question. It's just a thought I have, because when people die, what happened to me last year, if I may?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, you've experienced quite a lot of death recently.
Yeah, in the last year, 6 people that I know died, 2 of them quite tragically. And then, the others were long illnesses, or not even that long ill, you know, long periods of time, but they were ill and we expected it. And the most profound of it all was when my father died, which was in March last year, and it was extremely sudden. He started feeling unwell, went to the doctor on a Wednesday, still walked to the doctor's room, struggled a bit, made it back home. On the Friday morning, I spoke to the doctor, and she suggested he gets admitted, and he passed away on the Sunday evening. And what struck me there was my ability to go into a holding space, which I could only equate to the holding space that I felt when I was with women at birth.
Right.
And it was a profound experience. And I really felt like I knew exactly what to do. And I told you earlier that I've learned a lot from Muslim friends and colleagues over the years. And again, it was a matter of normalizing the process and owning the process. There's a very good friend of mine, and I know you know her as well, but when her father died, her and I and my daughter spent, it was a 2-year process, but right at the end, the 3 of us were there, and it was early evening, and we phoned their GP, and we just said, he has now passed away. And she said, what do you want to do? And we said, we want to just be here with him for tonight, and she can sort out the paperwork, whatever she needs to do with certifying the death, etc. But I told her that I've listened to his heart, you know, we had a few test runs. She kept on calling me, I think he's gone. And then I would come and say, no, he's not gone.
Right.
And we had the most amazing evening together. My friend, myself, and my daughter. My daughter ironed the robe that we were going to dress him in. We bathed him. We then tried to put his teeth back, which we couldn't.
Oh, wow.
That was quite... I mean, there was a lot of laughter and incredible amount of tears. And she went in the garden and picked as many flowers as she could. And we dressed him in this beautiful white robe that my brother bought us from Egypt and put flowers everywhere and, you know. And then she sat at his bedside right through the night and chanted. And she, she's a Buddhist, and my daughter slept. I still had to take her to school the next morning, and I slept and sat with my friend intermittently right through the night. And it was a knowing. And it came back, that was about 4 years ago. And then when my father died, that same doof, knowing kicked in for me, knowing what to do, how to sit there with him, hold him, not talk, touch, sense. I kept on silencing all these hysterical monitors that beeped telling me he's dying, you know, because he was going into very quick organ failure and it was happening rapidly. And I could see, you know, things shutting down and he would have, I don't know whether they were cardiac arrests or seizures, but he would jolt and jerk and the monitors would go crazy. And I just kept on turning them off one by one, silencing them. And at some point, the nurses came in because they could see from their side his IV line had blocked or stopped. Mm-hmm. And they turned the light on in order to have light to recite the line. And I just shook my head. I said, no. And this nursing sister, it was in an ICU, well, high care unit, looked at me. She looked in my eyes and she smiled. She turned the light off and she walked out. She knew, I knew, he was dying. The hospital experience is we must do the right thing. And the right thing there would be to keep the line in because maybe there's analgesia. I don't even know what. There was some chemo in there and some, I don't know, maybe analgesia. But he was far gone. And that was, again, that knowing. Knowing that he's my dad. This is our story. She doesn't have to put the line back in. She mustn't turn the light on. I felt a long, peaceful, when I sat down initially, it was about 7 in the evening and he died at 11. When I sat down at 7, I sat there knowing, I don't know how long this night is going to be. I don't know if it's going to be 5 hours, 10 hours. I don't know if he's going to go, but he is dying. I knew he was dying. I had to call the doctor on it and he didn't want to say it to me, but he did, you know, in the end. I said, Donnie, he's not going to make the night, is he? You know, and then I had to pull strings to get my mom to be able to come and my brother, and because he was in this isolation, it was, you know, a bone marrow transplant unit and they didn't want, he was in the wrong place to die. You know, he should have been in a private room, or if he hadn't crashed so quickly between the Friday and the Sunday, it would have been amazing at home, but it was too quick.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'm rambling a little bit.
No, it's a beautiful story and I'm really glad that you've shared it because it's, I think it's what we'd all want is to be there. I know that, you know, when someone is dying and you call to the bedside, you want to get there. You want to be there. And also for the person who is dying, you want to have your loved ones around you. So even if it was the wrong place, you made it the right place. It seems like there was a lot of intuition involved in knowing what to do and being supported by an experienced nurse who gets it, like
exactly.
You say. And that story of your friend and yourself and your daughter sitting vigil with her father, I mean, who experiences that? Not enough people, I don't think.
No, and we should. So powerful. Yeah.
This episode is proudly supported by AvBob, South Africa's leading funeral insurance and funeral service provider. So you might think, and you wouldn't be wrong, to get hold of AvBob because there's been a death and, yeah, they're imminently experienced to help you with that process. But when we look at the link between birth and death, it becomes plain that your very existence and the fact of your birth means you should call them during life. In fact, all of their products are for the living, the breathing, a whole suite of them, from education plans to holiday savings products, family savage, mortgage accelerators, whatever that is, but it sounds flippin' amazing. All the things that the living need to live and to die, knowing that everyone has been looked after. Peace of mind in death, I think, makes letting go that much easier for everyone. AvBob are a licensed financial services provider and member of ASISA, the Association for Savings and Investment South Africa. They have no shareholders and all their profits are shared with policyholders. Give them a shot to find out more. And let's go back to the show.
There's a wonderful report published last year called Revaluing Death by the Lancet.
Mm.
And the thesis of this report is that we need to revalue death and find its value, because its value has been thrown away, really.
Mm-hmm.
And it's by bringing death into the home, into families, talking about it, doing what we're doing now, that makes these types of gentle deaths more possible.
Mm-hmm.
I think COVID taught us that we can lose that experience. Mm. It can be taken away from us.
Oh, yes. When people weren't allowed to be, and that was one of the big outcries, you know, that people were dying alone.
Right.
And, you know, if I think of the other experiences last year as well, the same feeling that I got, like I did that evening with my father and that evening with my friend's father, that feeling of quiet waiting, when one of the other friends of mine who died last year, I would go and spend, because she also had a long illness, a couple of years, and then a rapid decline. So I would spend an hour or two every second day at her bedside to give her mom a reprieve. So I would go and sit there. And initially, I still did quite a lot. I could mobilize her. I could get her to the bathroom. And one time she threw up and there was matter in her hair, and they didn't know how to deal with that. So the mom called, and I went, and we orchestrated a funny little thing, and we cleaned it. But in the days, you know, subsequently, there was nothing. She just lay there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the last moments, once she opened her eyes, I was sitting with her brother, and she said a lovely, lovely. He said something to her like, "Oh, your little body is kaput." Put. And she opened and she just said, "Kaput." It was gorgeous.
Mm.
But then, you know, the next one or two times, it was again just that feeling of sitting there.
Mm.
It's a wonderful, peaceful thing to just, right. I sat there and I did some work. I marked.
So that's a quiet listening. When you're waiting for a birth, it's not so quiet.
It is. There's many hours.
Right.
It's only in transition and
right.
At the end. Oh, no. But birth is also extremely different for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, you get, it really depends on whether it's a first baby.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also something I'll get back to what
no,
you
that's
asked.
No, that's all good.
It's something that I was thinking about on the way over here. To talk about, we just get one death, but we get to, and we also only just get one birth, and that's where I was talking to you about the separation, because at the birth, there's the woman giving birth, so she has her first birth, and then she has her second and her third birth.
Right.
Each baby has its own single birth. But that process of the woman giving birth is what I'm talking about when I am at a person's bedside dying. So a woman giving birth to a first baby is almost, you cannot compare it to a woman giving birth to a second and a third baby. It's like chalk and cheese. It's a different creature. I always tell the students as well, you know, there's different sets of rules. There's different ways of behavior. So a first-time mom can be very loud and scared, the unknown.
Mm.
Then it's not a quiet waiting. But when you get to those second and third-time moms who have done it before, sometimes there's these lulls in the labor where everybody is waiting. One of my best waits was a woman in town once, and it's the first time I took my youngest daughter to a birth with me.
Okay.
And this woman, she had a toddler, and my daughter sort of kept the toddler happy and played with the toddler. And then at some point, the woman's labor sort of stopped and we were all lying there. She was in a big birth pool. We were lying on the carpet, paging through magazines. My daughter was playing with her little daughter. And obviously I have that little thing. Why has it stopped?
Mm.
I know as a midwife that it's normal, but our medicine books, our obstetric, you know, there's a problem. This is a red flag. There's an alert here. So we kept on monitoring. the fetal heart, and it was an hour, you know, of a lull in her active phase.
Mm-hmm.
And when she came out of that lull again, it just happened, and she just gave birth so spectacularly and calmly and beautifully. But that lull, that waiting, was a quiet waiting, a more quiet wait than I've probably had at many labors.
Hmm. Okay.
And wanting, you know, it's that urge of wanting to do something.
Yeah.
You just sometimes have to wait.
Okay.
And not do anything.
So you've been drawing some parallels between birth and death. And when we first spoke a few weeks ago, you'd mentioned this legion of people that you'd lost from your life last year, and mentioned that you felt that you would like to move towards being of service in the letting go of life instead of being there in the welcoming of life. Is that where you see yourself moving in the future? I mean, it sounds like you've already got quite a lot of experience of being with people during their last moments.
Mm. Yeah. So I did a little bit of homework, and I had to then sit back and think, what do I do? I want to be. And then I met with an amazing old, not old lady, but older than myself, lady that I met who worked for hospice many years. And I realized doing it the way I envisage would mean I'm going right back to where I was as a younger woman, as an on-call midwife.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to, at the moment, I have a very different family structure to what I did when I was younger. And I'm more tired. I don't have that vigilance or that's not the right word. I don't have that vibrant, strong body that could just cope with a few hours of sleep.
Is this a palliative care nurse then?
Mm,
okay.
Mm. Yeah, she was at Hospice False Bay.
Okay. But is that the role that you're talking about?
That's
now?
What I was first envisaging, because I am a registered nurse, and I have tremendous skills with, you know, IVs and managing that and putting catheters in and taking them out and cleaning wounds and cleaning colostomy bags and, you know, that sort of stuff. But then I realized, no, I can't go back there. And I had to seriously examine my motives and think, oh my gosh, you're selfish. And then I'm not. So what I really want to just do is just do the layman's course that many people do. And then I can, on a voluntary basis, go and help when I can.
Yeah.
And I don't have to bring my medical expertise to it, because that's kind of, in a way, also what I'm saying I want to get away from.
Right.
I don't want to be the medical person.
Okay.
I would like to be the person who sits there.
No,
I want to do things against the rules.
Right.
I want to do the things that people actually want to do and not should be doing.
Yeah.
Not illegal stuff.
No, of course. When you become used to attending births on a regular basis, what did you find that did for you or to you? Does one sort of feed off it in any sense?
Yeah. I think that was one of the problems for me. I retrospectively, I can clearly see it now. But even at the time, I started realizing that there's a feeding off other people's energy and
the kind of magic.
The magic, the love, the passion between those people, the mother and the father, or the two mothers, or whatever the scenario may be, seeing their baby, crying over the baby, talking to the baby. Well, the magic. And then you run from birth to birth and you get excited. You get exhausted because you hold everything together. If there are emergencies, you've got to deal with the medical side on the side of it and still trying to keep the magic
right up
for the people.
Yeah.
And then parts of your own life suffer.
Yeah, I'd imagine
children
sort of leaving the preparation of supper to go off to another magic moment. Why
and
not?
Birthday parties and Christmas and Easter and all the things that always take priority in people's lives is always on the back burner if you're an on-call midwife.
Hmm.
And that, you know, that's where teamwork comes in, but then it's still a negotiation. I get Christmas, you get Easter, and then there's a cascade of births and you get called in anyway.
Hmm.
But I don't say that's like that for everybody.
Of course.
But for me, I certainly think that we need to examine why we want to be at births, you know.
Right.
So the rush for everybody to want to be at births, is it to support the people, or is it because we're trying to find something for ourselves? And then that same question I'm wondering about being at deaths, you know.
Yeah. Absolutely. I just want to get written into someone's will just before they
die.
That
will obviously be so clever.
Yeah,
you must do their feet.
So I don't exactly have a retirement plan. So I was thinking, at least I could get a good record collection or a nice vintage car or something.
Yeah, I think you've watched a few Hollywood movies. I mean, I remember the one birth, not birth, listen to me now, the one death last year was a little old lady. Again, not so old. She was probably only 70. And she lived in a very, very rundown, extremely poor area close to where we are. And I knew her over the years because she cared for incredibly deeply and well for my best friend's mother when she was aging and then dying.
Okay.
And then she cared for that same best friend's husband's mother. So she was in that family involved for many years. I've known this woman for 15 years. And then she got sick. And my friend and myself went and helped care for her there. We tried desperately to get a last couple of emergency procedures out of Grotesky, and we took her there, and it was the thing that the two of us could move in, do these procedures and alleviate some pain or discomfort, but it was the actual family person who is the waiting one, the constant caring one, like with my old friend as well, whose father, she was the one who was there every night through the night. Even if she had breaks and they were carers, it still comes back to that person, you know, and you can never replace that as a death doula.
Exactly.
It remains the person's close, intimate family member who should be supported.
Yeah.
Same as at the birth, you know,
right. No, but I agree. I don't think our culture is ready to outsource that kind of waiting to anyone, especially on a sort of paid basis.
But you see, Sean, I think the problem with our culture is we've stopped doing it ourselves.
That's
so
right.
We don't know how to. And that's perhaps where this role comes in of, you know, quote-unquote, the death doulas.
Yeah.
People who can then help the family to do it again.
Mm.
Because our people don't know what to do.
It's interesting, though, when you described how you and your friend and her daughter sat with her father, it sounded like a completely intuitive thing.
Hmm.
And I know my ex-wife cared for her mother during her last few months peerlessly. I mean, amazingly well.
Hmm.
And it was entirely intuitive.
Hmm.
So if we allow ourselves to have the opportunity to do this kind of work in our families, and I hesitate to call it work. It's more of a duty or a ritual or a rite or something. But it's not something people want to talk about. We don't want to contemplate someone's passing. We'd rather not talk about grandpa dying because that might make us sad. So it's in pushing away these feelings that we limit our opportunity to really feel the so-called magic that's there at death and at birth, I think.
Yeah. I don't know why, but while you were talking now, I thought of something. And for me, the one big difference between being at a birth and being at a death is this person is dying. So when they die, they're dead. And that's the desired outcome, which takes about 90% of the stress away for me, who have been dealing with birth all my life. Whereas at the birth, you are trying or working towards or facilitating towards life.
Yeah, it sounds much more energetic, or much more...
And the responsibility, yeah, you know? Huge. So it's like a... So just from a midwife point of view, you know, not as a friend witnessing a birth, okay, or the family having their... Just as a midwife, it's so much easier being with my friends and my father who was dying, because they had to die. And it was wonderful that we could be there and that it happened. And it's, you know...
It strikes me, though, that we also think that death and life are two extremes. And, you know, then we have this thing called life in between these two mystical moments. And death happens at the end of life. But you've had 6 deaths last year during life. So when I remember that death is part of life, every day that my skin is being shed, that my blood is regenerating, that my hair is going gray, that, you know, I'm over the hill, actually, already.
Yeah, me too.
And death is part of my life. It's not some event that waits at the end of my journey, but I'm already walking with death, in a sense. And it begins the moment you're born. Carry on, yeah.
So because of everything that happened last year and all the deaths and being critically part of some of them and, you know, part of some of them just from a distance, it made me think about death a lot. And it made me speak to my husband about death and dying. And I realized that I am completely unafraid of death, but I'm petrified of him dying. So it's about the staying behind. That for me was the big thing. If you know, I have no idea what happens when you die. And I really don't mind what happens when you die. It's about how you live. And I mean, all those typical profound things happened. Like when my dad died, 2 days later, when all the family were there, this little bird came and sat half in the house on a place where there's never been a bird and went berserk. It looked like he was having a little seizure and then flew off. And, you know, so that happens. That stuff happens. And even if you're not romantically inclined, you can't deny these very strange things that happen. So there is stuff, and that's not, I know that's not our conversation.
No, it is.
Okay. But yeah. So I know there's stuff, but I don't know what it is. And I've read books about, you know, that, I can't remember his name, but he was a neurosurgeon and then he got so sick and then he died and then he, quite an old book, but a very beautifully lovely written book of his whole death experience and coming back. Someone gave it to me after my dad died. But I'm so actually not interested. All I know is I don't mind when and if I die, I die. But I just don't want him to die, you know, or my children to die, because it is about the staying behind and missing the person. That's what it's like for me.
So that's what death has taught you quite recently. What has birth taught you about life?
Well, I think one of the big things is it's shown me the strength in people.
Right.
And it has shown me, like I said right at the beginning of this podcast to you, it's shown me how people have strength because of, I don't know, is faith the right word?
Yeah.
Belief, faith in whatever.
Right.
That people draw strength from
somewhere. So you've seen people drawing from a deep source.
People from all the different, you know, types of belief. I've seen people draw strength. And I've seen people flap around when they are ungrounded or, grounded's the wrong word, but if they have nothing to grasp for.
Okay.
If it's just a sort of an existence or quite a...
I understand.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
So I've seen that strength and I've seen the unpredictability and the fact that we are not in control. With birth, we're not in control. You can steer it by eating healthily, exercising enough, wiggling this way, wiggling that way in your birth process, standing forward. But if there are sometimes stuff that we are just not in control, you know, the neonatal deaths, the stillbirths, the fetal abnormalities, the, you know,
Do you think that the way that someone is born influences their life? I'm asking you this question because my youngest child, Danny Boy, he was born at home in the bath. And I feel like he landed so well on this earth that's given him a sense of stability.
Mm.
Do you think that there's a link between the way you were born and your and the way you live? I mean,
I would love to say yes, but okay. I don't.
Yeah.
I would love to say yes, you know, and people always say, oh, I was so late. You know, I was post-dates and I'm always late for appointments. People love to draw those little conclusions. Or I was born before my mom could get to the hospital and I always do everything in a rush. People say that sort of stuff. But if I look at my children, you know, I had two spectacularly calm, beautiful births and I do not have spectacularly calm children. They're beautiful, but they're not spectacularly calm.
Okay.
I don't know, Sean.
Yeah.
What I can say on that topic is perhaps that it has the way a child is born or the way a birth unfolds may have a lot to do with how the mother conducts herself after the birth. You know, so if it was an empowering birth, the mother will go into the beginning of her early, you know, puerperium as an empowered mother. And I think that will have a profound effect on the baby.
So it's useful to look beyond that moment into what the experience meant for the mother.
And how empowered she is and how calm she is and how she's nurturing the parents, the carers.
Is there anything else that you think, want
to say? No, this was just a very, very lovely conversation.
Yeah,
I hope it's been helpful. Or,
of course. Well, it's a privilege for me because I'll be eternally grateful to you for helping Sam come into the world.
I remember that birth.
Such a happy guy.
Very well. I remember the backache. It was quite something.
Yeah.
Wild first births.
Yeah.
I'm telling you.
And second was much easier.
Yep.
You're right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much for the seeds that you're planting. You know, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
All right, sister.
Thank you, Sean.
Take it easy.
Bye.
Ciao. And we're going to leave it there. Thank you so much for listening to the show and for joining us and for spreading the word about How to Die. Please remember that your donations make a huge difference to the sustainability of this show and this little project. It's always amazing to hear from you. Please drop me an email. My address is SEAN, spelled Sean, at howtodie.co.za. Yeah, some final thoughts. Births are usually celebrated. Deaths, not so much. Perhaps we could celebrate death more by having a better relationship with our own birth, our own existence, our own journey to this inevitable moment. James Hollis, the Jungian psychoanalyst and writer, who is a hero of mine, speaks so eloquently of the necessity of death for birth to happen, for renewal and growth and change through life. But that's not easy. Perhaps that's why we push it away. Let's bring it closer. It's my privilege to have spent this time with you. I wish you well until we meet again, inshallah. May every step be peace. Cheers.